This is a Sound Rebel podcast.
To work with us on your podcast, go to soundrebel.co.uk.
Before we get into today's chat with Justin, and it is a fantastic episode, he shares so honestly about his alcohol-free journey. We wanted to give you a heads up as to some of the themes and issues that are discussed throughout today's episode that some people may find triggering. There are references to suicide and suicidal thoughts, child abuse and childhood trauma. So if you decide that this episode is not for you, we completely understand.
Influence is no longer just a podcast. Our online community is buzzing with people like you.
Hi, my name's Helen, and I stopped drinking alcohol almost exactly 7 years ago. When I stopped drinking, I really felt a lot of benefits. My health was better, my finances were better, my attention was better, and I really felt like I started to kind of grow up as a person. At times it was still difficult, at times even now, I feel like sometimes it's hard to explain to people why I don't drink, and sometimes still I feel like I'm a bit alone on this journey. But a couple of years ago I found Over the Influence, and that really changed things a lot for me, and I just felt like I wasn't alone in this journey anymore. It's just so nice to have this massive connection with all these like-minded people. Come along to Over the Influence and be part of an amazing community.
You've heard the podcast, now join the conversation. Go to overtheinfluence.co.uk.
Welcome to Over the Influence. It is fantastic to have you listening. If maybe you are finding us for the very first time, allow us to introduce ourselves to you. My name is Sharon Hartley. I am based in Lancashire in the northwest of England. I turned 50. I don't know why I keep referencing my age. I think it's because it was quite a big deal. I didn't think I'd be 50 and 5 years sober. So that's where I'm at. In a nutshell, I drank too quickly, too often, and I drank far too much. I decided to take a break from booze, which was back in 2018 now. Some days it feels like yesterday, other days it feels like a lifetime ago. I did it slap bang in the middle of my 40s, and here I am today, chatting to you with my lovely co-host Ben, banging on about sobriety week in, week out. Safe to say, it has changed my flipping life, and I love it. Ben, how are you?
Very well. Thank you, Sharon. I'm Ben. I'm 35. I live in Liverpool. I am husband to Jem. I am stepdad to Alfie and Millie, dad to baby Leo. And before I tell you more about me, I just want to say, Shaz, if you are somebody who started this on the 1st of January 2024, it's very likely that you are currently in what we call the shit zone when this episode comes out. Okay. Would just like to say to you, keep going. You're here. Fabulous. Keep on listening. The shit zone is the stage where we see it between about 50 and 70 days.
It varies, doesn't it? It varies.
Yeah, but it's when people get to that point where that little voice, cause that's what I want to talk about, a little voice that's going, oh, God, you've done this for ages. What have you got to prove? You've done 2 months without this. Go on, you can just have one. How about like special occasions and events? For me, I had a little voice in my head, and I like to say that I didn't have a rock bottom. I'm going to nick a phrase from someone in our community. I didn't have a rock bottom, but I could see it from where I was standing. What I mean by that, going back to Danny a few weeks ago, it's progressive. It gets worse. That's how this works. You know, for me, I stopped drinking at a point when I wasn't dependent on alcohol. I can say that I wasn't physically dependent on alcohol. I didn't have withdrawal. Having said that, my drinking habits had changed. In my 20s, I drank because it was fun. In my 30s, I started drinking because I was stressed. And let's face it, it was only going one way. Over the Influence came into my life at the perfect time. And my message is just listen to that little voice. If you've got that little voice in your head going, this isn't right, you're drinking on your own here. Or, you know, do you really need that pint at lunch? Just listen to it. Removing alcohol is the best decision I ever made in my entire life. I'm so grateful for it because it led to lots of other great things. Would I be married? Would Leo be here? Big, big question, Shaz.
Would I be in your life? In that list, come on.
No, probably not. You know, and you are the shining light of it.
I love your enthusiasm, and I loved I love the fact that from literally day one, I have been on your journey right by your side, like this nagging thing in your ear for, well, it's coming up for the best part of 4 years, isn't it, Ben? And it is.
Well, 4 years in July, yeah.
It's amazing. It is life-changing. If you are in the shit zone, it does end. Don't worry, you will come out the other side.
Going.
Because our guest today, this intro has gone on for 7 hours. Apologies.
It usually does, Justin.
sorry, Justin. Seriously, we need to wrap this up. I'm Sharon, he's Ben. We're both sober and we love it. Welcome
Justin's
to
us. Here.
Justin's here. But we're going stateside again. Today's guest is based in Gainesville, in Florida, in the actual US of A. You know, I get excited when we go to a sunny state in America. He's called Justin B. Long, and we are so delighted to welcome you to the podcast. And thank you, Justin, for your patience for that long, rambling intro. How are you?
Oh, thank you guys so much for having me on the show. I can also give a long, rambling intro if you'd like. I'm
yes,
happy
please.
To be part of the
Love
team.
You too.
Go for it. Just carry on. Just carry on, Justin. Give us a bit
All
of
right.
an intro. Long and rambling.
Well, I am 48 years old. Is that right? Yes, 48. I'm a 1975 model. So yes, I'm 48. I have been sober. I just celebrated 16 years a few weeks ago.
Wow.
It sounds crazy to me too, I got to say. But I love my sobriety birthday time because it's a chance for me to reflect like where I was at 5 years ago, where I was at 10 years ago, where I was at 15 years ago, and then where I was at 20 years ago. Because 20 years ago, I was way over my head in the shit zone. Absolutely no question about that. But sobriety has been very challenging at times, but incredibly rewarding for me. In my life, I've heard this said in meetings before, and I used to think that it was kind of a snide thing to say, but now I 1000% agree that if I had sat down 5 years sober and tried to write out how great I wanted my life to be, I would have sold myself short from where I'm at today, because life is amazing and you get in what you put out. You get out what you put in. Is that it? One of those things?
You get out what you put in. Yeah, it's exactly yeah. that. We say it a lot, Justin.
It's been an amazing journey for me and it's not over. I'm still going. So, but this is part of my journey and I am very excited to talk to you guys today.
Love that. That wasn't long and rambling. I think that was quite concise.
That was professional.
That was well done.
Yeah, you've got to give a plug to your podcast at some point this episode.
Absolutely,
Justin, because that's how you do it, Shaz, let's face it. Would you mind, Shaz, if I jumped in first?
Go for
it. Because, Justin, just doing the maths here, so you're 48 now, you gave up 16 years ago, so you were 32
that's
when you
right.
stopped drinking.
Yeah,
I was 31 or 32 when I stopped drinking, and it's not a common thing for 32-year-old men to do.
I don't think so. I don't know. I got sober in a 12-step program, and there was a lot of really young people there, and there was a lot of really old people there. There was not a lot of in-the-middle guys that were my age, or women, but there were a few. But my sponsor that I eventually found, it took me 2 years to find him, but he also got sober in February, and he was also 32 when he got sober, and he was absolutely terrific. So I think it's the perfect age for amazing people to get sober.
There you go.
Agreed.
Ben,
and
said
now
it.
Back to you, Shaz. Yeah, there we are.
You spoke then about your 16 years of sobriety, and you know, you can look back at where you were 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 15 years ago. Can we go back right before that, back before 16 years? I'm rubbish at maths, but Ben does the calculations. I always get them wrong. Let's maybe go back 20 years or so, and share with us as much as you're happy to, Justin, about what life looked like for you as a drinker, and maybe even before that.
Yeah, I really, when I look at my life story as a whole, it starts at 32 when I got sober, because that's also when I started getting self-aware and just even understanding who I was and why I was doing what I was doing and feeling what I was feeling. And from there, the story goes forward and backward at the same time. Like the longer that I stayed sober, the farther back in time that I went trying to get to the source of my challenges and what it was that made me drink alcoholically in the first place. Because I realized very early on in sobriety, I learned that alcohol was not a problem for me. Alcohol was my solution. And my problem was the way that I feel about myself. And alcohol fixed the way that I felt about myself for a very long time. It worked fantastic. When I was in high school, And then when I got out of high school and went into the Army, like, alcohol made me feel wonderful about myself. And that was the only time that I had ever felt that way in my whole life. And so I associated feeling good with about myself with drinking. Like, that's how Justin functions, is drinking makes me good. When I'm not drinking, I'm not good. And, you know, alcohol is falls under the same laws as everything else, the law of diminishing returns, where it works less and less over time. And the way that I felt about myself did not improve. And, you know, you can't drink 24/7. You just can't do it. And the periods in between me being able to drink, which was usually, you know, the first 2/3 of the day when I was at work trying to pay for all of this stuff, you know, I still had to live in my head. And towards the end of my drinking, I wouldn't say that I was actively suicidal, but if I got hit by a dump truck on the way home from work, I would have been okay with it. I really was not happy with anything in my life. I didn't like my job. I had a great paying job. I didn't like my boss really, really, really. And I learned later on why I didn't like my boss, but he was a lot like my dad and made me feel really inferior. He worked very hard to make me feel inferior, and it was very effective. And I didn't like my relationship that I was in. I didn't like anything about my life. It was a wreck. And I didn't feel like there was anything else that I could do but just keep existing. And I felt like, you know, I was 32. I had an awful long, 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 long drudgery life ahead of me, just slogging through a job that I don't like so that I can come home to a family I don't want to be in, and just try to drink myself into a period of acceptance for a few hours and then get up and do it all again tomorrow. Like, that's a horrible existence. But, you know, the farther I got into recovery, the more I learned how to become self-aware. But my mentor, he took me through a workbook called A Gentle Path Through the 12 Steps by Patrick Carnes, which we called the Brutal Path because it was absolutely brutal. It took me a year to work through that. But it's basically a 250-page workbook on going through the 12 steps. And it really takes a deep dive into the why behind the what. And that's when I started to understand, like, I just started with a little bit of sunshine on the way that I feel about myself and what that stuff is based on. And it took me years of working on that and then getting into therapy to really get the full picture that, you know, I had a childhood filled with traumatic events and abuse. My dad was a workaholic. He didn't drink, but he had a very troubled childhood, and he took out all of his challenges through work. He felt like if he worked hard enough, maybe he'd feel better about himself and get the pat on the back from his dad, right? My mom was not the chosen child in her family, but her little sister was. So my mom felt marginalized and never a part of, and she was struggling with her own inner demons. And so my parents came together as two very imperfect people with a lot of their own challenges. And I was a victim of circumstance in that relationship. So my mom, not being a disciplinarian, would make me pull in the big trash can from the dump, from the alley, and sit inside that and wait for my dad to come home and give me a spanking when I'd done something wrong. So my mom would throw me away on a regular basis, make me sit in the trash. My dad was the disciplinarian and the workaholic. So he would have this long list of chores for me to do every day. And then he would come home from work and we would go through those chores and he would pick out all the things that I did wrong. And then I would get a spanking for that. And so from my two primary caregivers, I learned from very early on that no matter how hard I try, I'm never going to be good enough, and that I don't really have any value and I can be disposed of at any time. And those things, when they, you know, that was impressed upon me at a very young age. My mom was super religious. And so I also learned that I can never question my parents, that they're always right. And so I learned, you know, from single digit years and then reinforced all the way up through high school that is who Justin is. Justin is a loser. Justin is never going to get this right. He has no value as a human being. And we treat other people, or we teach other people how to treat us. So I went to school with that attitude and became the outcast because that's how, what I believed about myself. That's how I taught other people to treat me. So I didn't have any place in the world that I was plugged in. And so, yeah, I had a horrible self-image. I had self-esteem issues. I couldn't accept criticism. Like, all of those beliefs about who I was followed me right into the Army as an adult. and out into the workforce and into my relationship. And I never, ever questioned those things. I just hated myself because, you know, why wouldn't I? And that is why alcohol was such a big part of my life. And it's also why I crashed and burned, because I can't maintain that much of a negative self-belief indefinitely. And there's no external tool like alcohol or drugs or gambling or sex or any of the other myriad of compulsive behaviors that we engage in when we don't feel good about ourselves. None of those things were going to work for me long term. So thank God I didn't get into a lot of that other stuff. If I'd ever found drugs, I don't know if I would have survived it. But, you know, alcohol was my solution until it wasn't anymore. And I have now come to the understanding that trauma therapy is the only real solution that there ever was for anybody in my position.
Justin, already, it's fabulous to have you here. I've written down so many things. I've written down, started to become self-aware, and I've underlined it. Alcohol fits the law of diminishing returns and circled that. I've also got here artist easel, because you've got an easel in the background of your Zoom call. And I don't think no one who's got an artist easel has a dull and boring existence, as you thought they had. They don't. They just don't. You know, the thing I'd really like to pick up on, first of all, Justin, last night, Shaz mocks me for this, but I don't know if Married at First Sight has made it to American TV screens, but it's a reality TV show which Shaz thinks is very lowbrow. Actually, it discusses lots of very important and very deep themes, right? Last night on the couch, the idea is that two people meet at the altar, they're paired together by experts, and then they kind of build their relationship together with the experts helping them. And there's this couple on the couch, and they said, "You don't like yourself very much, do you?" And he said, "No, I hate myself," was the phrase he used. And my first thought was, where do you even start? If you're somebody who's, you know, used, like, "I hate myself," where do you even begin? You've reflected on that. You've talked about how you weren't where you wanted to be, you weren't with the people surrounding you, weren't necessarily the people, but also, you know, how you felt about yourself. Where do you start, Justin, when you really are at a point where you think, "I'm here and I'm not keen on this guy"?
It's a lot of work, I will tell you that. I spent all of my life, because I was, my parents rejected me, so I rejected myself. I spent all of my time trying to be someone else, right? So I had years and years and years of layers of layers and layers of masks and pieces of other people's identity that I tried to take on as my own, trying to be someone that the world would accept. So when I started trying to figure out how to not even like myself or love myself, but how to even just accept who I am for a minute, I had to figure out who I am. And it took, I would say, especially going through the brutal path was the beginning of that process of me stripping away those layers and getting down to a blank slate on who I am, not who I'm, you know, who is Justin hiding from the world, not as who I'm presenting to the world, if that makes sense. So I'd get all these masks off. I tried to be a tough guy. I tried to be, you know, Mr. Macho. I wanted to be the guy that other guys feared and women swooned over, you know, all this bullshit that we have in our head. So, like, I was oozing toxic masculinity, but I had these thousands of beliefs that I had to cycle through and figure out, do I believe this or do I not believe this? Is this part of who I am or is this not who I am? And it started, I'll say the very first thing that cracked the ice on that was a steak. And I grew up poor, so we didn't have steak very often. But on the rare occasion that we did, my dad said a good steak ought to be burned to a crisp. And I didn't ever question that. So I went all of my adult life into my 30s thinking, you know, if you're going to eat a steak, it ought to be burned to a crisp. And that's how I had all my steaks. And I got into, we'll get to the artist easel in a second because that's part of my story here. But I got into music first when I got sober. I needed to fill 8 hours a day with not drinking with something. So I started playing guitars with a guy that I worked with. And that turned into a band And we recorded an album in my living room and went and started playing some gigs locally. But after one of those gigs, we went to a steakhouse to celebrate, you know, having put on a show. And the steakhouse was horrified by my request that they burn my steak to a crisp. And so we had this big come to Jesus meeting at the side of the table about, you know, how to eat a steak. And my buddies and the waitress convinced me to try a medium rare steak. They said, you know, if you don't like it, that's absolutely fine. We'll give it to you for free. And so they brought me a medium rare steak, and it was the best thing I ever had in my life. And I was like, oh my God, you know, my dad, Mr. Infallible, Mr. Can't Be Questioned, was wrong about steak. And that put a little hairline crack out into the ice. And from there on out, I started to, you know, investigating all sorts of beliefs that I had that I inherited from my parents. And I found out that I didn't believe hardly any of that stuff. You know, my political stance, my belief about people who are of a different sexual orientation than me, or people who are a different color than I am. Like, I had all of these inherited beliefs, and some, not all of them came from my dad. Some of them came from just me trying to project the image of being Mr. Macho Man. But I had all of these beliefs, and I realized that I didn't believe in any of those. So when I got down to the bottom of that, which took a long time, I had this whole different persona. I found out that, you know, I like painting. I like art a lot. I like playing guitars and writing songs. I like doing all these things that I thought were too effeminate. Like the people would make fun of me if they saw me doing that stuff. So I rejected all of those things. I found out, you know, that for me to figure out who I am, I need to start experimenting with things, because I've never allowed myself to do anything other than what I thought other people would want me to do. You know, I'm living my life trying to meet somebody else's expectations that I'm dreaming up, you know, like it's not even real. I just never really thought about this stuff outwardly. But for me, in order to stop hating myself, I had to figure out who I am in the first place. And when I got down to that's when the fundamental shift started to take place. Of it's not that I hate me. It's probably not even that my dad hated me or rejected me. My dad was so involved in his own misery that he probably barely noticed me in reality. But because that was the entirety of my existence and my information input, I thought that was the whole world, right? Like in therapy, I had this amazing insight, because my dad controlled everything about my life. Like I was so under his thumb, and I hated it and I rebelled against it, but I still did everything he told me to do and still hoped that one of these days I would get that pat on the back, right? But in therapy, I realized that I thought my dad controlled the whole world and dominated the whole world, but he had a crap job where he was at the bottom of the ladder on that. So he wasn't dominating anything at work. His wife was crazy. His house was falling apart. He was always having to work on the house. The car was always broke down. He was always in the driveway working on the car. Like everything in his world was falling apart, and he didn't dominate or control anything except for me. And I was never able to see that. I didn't have enough perspective to understand that. And so in my pursuit of trying to dominate the world so that I could feel good about myself and get my dad's stamp of approval, I had abandoned everything that I ever even imagined I would like in favor, because I assume if I like it, everybody else is going to ridicule me for it. So therefore I reject it. So I have completely reinvented myself. When I look at myself at 48 compared to where I was at 28, the only constant is that I'm still incredibly good looking.
Is the beard always been there, Justin? Have you always been a beard guy?
Yeah, I've always been a beard guy. But I will tell you, I could not even say that I was okay looking until I was probably 10 years sober. Like, I still held so many resentments against myself. I hated the way I looked, the way my voice sounds, you know, all of those things. You know, just turning self-loathing into self-love is a long, long, slow process. But we'll get to EMDR and trauma therapy. But I want to say right now up front that it is 1,000% possible to change the way that you feel about yourself. And I love getting into the weeds on that stuff, getting into the science behind it. But because not drinking was never going to get me there. But not drinking was necessary for me to start down that road, if that makes sense.
Yeah, your voice, I could listen to it all day, by the way. I could listen to it all day.
Well, you can subscribe to Straight from the Horse Doctor's Mouth, and there's 137 episodes to keep you busy for a while.
Brilliant, brilliant. We'll talk about that. We will get to that. I'm only just getting over the steak story. Of everything you've shared, it made me cry. That I got dead emotional listening to you share that and everything else as well.
We're going to say that, aren't we, in the months to come? We're going to go, who said that thing on the podcast? And we're going to go,
about the steak.
It was medium rare steak guy. Yeah.
It was him. It was just to be long.
Justin, yeah.
Just to be long. Thank you for sharing so personally and such painful stuff. You preempted my next question and you talked about this. You said that it's completely possible to rediscover who you are. And while I was listening to you, it sounded very much like at the age of 32, you started from scratch. You like had no idea who you were. And it's utterly heartbreaking to hear about your childhood and your lack of self-worth. And you said if you saw a dump truck and it, you know, hit you, you weren't that bothered. And then to go from there to where you are now, I can't imagine there's not been one day when you've not been discovering something new about yourself, Justin.
Well, one of the things that I learned early on is to lean into change and lean into discomfort, because everything that I've gone through has made my life better. You know, everything that I've gone through in recovery, the hard times. And I will say, at 2 years sober, 3 years sober, there were times when I was still so filled with self-loathing that I didn't want to be a part of what was going on. You know, because taking away the alcohol was my tool that made me feel better about myself. And when I took that away and I didn't replace it with positive mental health, which took me a long time to get to, like all that loathing was still there, still eating my lunch. So I had to lean into doing some work on myself and seeking out change, like actively seeking out change, or else I wasn't going to make it. I was less worried about relapse. I was more worried about suicide, because, you know, you can be very miserable when you're sober. Like just taking the booze away or the drugs away, that doesn't solve the stuff. That just helps you take the shovel out of your hand so you can quit digging the hole. But once I got through the brutal path, like that was a big giant stepping stone for me, and realizing, you know, that I was going a completely wrong direction my whole life, and I was blind to it, that I didn't have any self-awareness. And then, you know, once I went from there and got into some counseling, not even trauma therapy at that point, but just regular counseling, I started making like significant progress by going back and looking at childhood stuff and talking about my drinking days and why I hated myself, and really getting into that stuff and shining the flashlight on it helped make me feel better about all of that. And every time I did another one of those things, whether it was, you know, the brutal path or therapy or trauma therapy and all the myriad of smaller things in between, like every one of those changes that I made about myself made my life better. And so that's why, you know, sobriety birthdays are still a big deal for me, because even at the end, at like year five, I could compare where I was at year four and say, I have made a lot of progress. You know, I haven't even thought about killing myself in 6 months, and that's an amazing thing. So, you know, that progress, that continuous progress from continuous work, has really made me commit to a lifestyle of continuous progress. Like I always want to be working on self-improvement, because still today at 16 years sober, my life is tremendously better than it was a few years ago. And that's because I'm still doing things to try to improve my life. And going through the process of trauma therapy, I want to talk about EMDR for a minute, because that's a huge part of why I love myself today, which is still a novel thing for me to say.
But before you do, Justin, I apologize. Sorry to interrupt you. Please, can you explain what EMDR is?
Yeah. So EMDR is eye movement rapid desensitization. Basically, it's a form of trauma therapy. And it's been out since the 80s. They use it a lot in PTSD and people that have suffered like major traumatic, like single traumatic events, like a car wreck or watching a loved one get killed in front of you, you know, combat. There's a million things that give you trauma, right? The big capital T trauma. But then there's also people like me. I never had a big capital T trauma, but I had 200 million lowercase T traumas, you know, over the course of 20 years. So what we have learned, and brain science is a fascinating thing, and there's a lot of great podcasts out there that talk about this. But there's a lot of people researching brain science and trauma and self-loathing and all those things, self-esteem. What we know at this point is that the amygdala, all your emotions pass through the amygdala. When you have an event of any sort, emotions pass through the amygdala. They get sent on to other parts of the brain, the hippocampus and all this, and get processed and turned into memories. But when we experience a trauma, those emotions don't go through the amygdala. They get hung up there. They stay there. And then when we experience something that is similar to that, we have that knee-jerk reaction, like my inability to accept criticism. You know, when my boss, you know, at age 40 and I'm working at a manufacturing plant and my boss says, hey, you know, you counted the pipe, but your number doesn't match what the computer says. I'm ready to fight to the death to defend my honor because, you know, I feel like my life is on the line here, which is a ridiculous overreaction to him saying you need to go double check your count, right? But that inability to accept criticism is because I've still got so much negative emotion sitting in my amygdala about my dad's criticism of everything that I ever did, that I have this incredible overreaction. So EMDR, what that does, they use a thing called bilateral stimulation. And sometimes it's a light flashing left, right. Sometimes it's a buzzing paddle that buzzes left, right. Left, right, left, right. It doesn't really matter what the stimulus is. The idea is that when you have left, right engagement, it lights up both hemispheres of your brain at the same time. And that's what has to happen in order for emotions to get pushed through the amygdala while you're accessing memories at the same time. And so we use that bilateral stimulation, and then we go back to, say, the firewood stack that I had to stack that firewood perfect every day, and then my dad would come home, and we would inspect it. And if any pieces were sticking out, he would give me a spanking for all the pieces sticking out, right? So with my therapist, I go back to that moment, and I stand beside my 8-year-old self at the firewood stack, and I, you know, get an adult perspective on what's actually happening in that situation. And with adult me, I can look at that and say that 8-year-old Justin stacked the firewood just like he did every day. The house was heated. Nobody was cold. He did a great job. His dad didn't understand how to properly motivate him, so he punished him in an effort to try to make him try to be better, right? So I know that I was not a loser, and I was worthy of a pat on the back for the efforts that I put in. And so in that moment, I can change my emotions about how I felt about myself at that point. I can change my emotions about how I felt about my dad. I can change my understanding of who I was then, which over the course of time changes my understanding of who I am now. And so we use that process to visit all these different childhood memories of 8-year-old Justin, 10-year-old Justin sitting inside the trash can. When I look at that with an adult perspective, you know, I understand the kid is in the trash can is beating himself up because he couldn't keep his mouth shut, and he knew that this was a consequence. He thinks it's his fault that he's in the trash can. I know that if I saw my neighbor put their kid in the trash can as a punishment, I would think that there's some horrible child abuse going on over there, and we need to get law enforcement involved. That is not okay. So I can change my understanding, have some empathy for myself, allow my 8-year-old self to not have 100% control over his emotions in his mouth, and I can feel compassion for myself instead of feeling disdain. So when I change all of these emotions about my child self and all of these different situations, as a cumulative whole, I now have a positive recollection of who I've always been. Even into, say, 25-year-old Justin, who was a raging alcoholic running around trying to screw everybody at the bar so that he could feel good about himself for a second for getting accepted. Like, I understand how he got there. I don't approve of the behavior, and I'm a little embarrassed that a lot of other people saw me do a lot of things that I'm not proud of, but I absolutely understand why that stuff happened. My past experiences created that situation. It was never not going to happen. the remarkable thing is that I can have empathy for that guy instead of hating him and being so horribly ashamed of him that I want to kill myself so that no one else ever has to deal with any of that, right? So trauma therapy helped me change my core belief emotions about who I am and who I've always been, from negative to positive. And with all of the work that I did leading up to that in recovery about discovering who I really am, and then with that discovering who I've always been, I can look in the mirror and be proud of myself today. Like, I am amazing, and I've always been okay. And the fact that my parents couldn't see that is not a reflection of me. That's a reflection of them. And that is a fundamental life change that you can't get anywhere else.
Justin, that sounds amazing. And I've just been Googling, because EMDR, I've not heard of it before. And I thought, oh, maybe, you know, is it something that is, you know, more prevalent in the States than it is here? So I've just typed in where I live, Liverpool, into the UK Association website for EMDR. And there's loads and loads and loads.
Probably like, one right down the road from me. Different,
yeah, yeah, which is nuts. Yeah. I think my question is, so you talked about how the start of all of this for you was self-awareness.
Yep.
And trauma therapy and EMDR helped you with that process of becoming self-aware, challenging your own beliefs that actually weren't your beliefs and everything else that you've talked about. I think one thing I'd like to ask you is that in the UK, there are potentially quite a lot of barriers to therapy. You know, it could be a financial barrier. We are blessed to have the National Health Service here, but then, you know, a barrier could be waiting lists, for example. And it's something that we've experienced ourselves, that, you know, it was, we could get free counselling on the NHS when we needed it, but not for a couple of years was the message, which, you know, it's difficult.
Right.
I suppose another barrier that we've got here in the UK, and I think this is different to the States, is stigma, actually. You know, that can be a huge barrier for people.
It is here too.
You see, I always thought that the States was kind of, you know, generally a bit more accepting that, you know, it's good to talk regularly to somebody who knows what they're on about. But interesting that their stigma exists there too. I think my question is, how can you start that kind of process of self-awareness if therapy isn't an option? Like, is it possible to do that yourself, to become self-aware yourself, or do you need someone else to be there to help shine a light on the issues?
I think you can definitely become self-aware without professional help, for sure. And, you know, I got a lot of my self-awareness before I ever saw a therapist for the first time. I was, I want to say, eight or 9 years sober before I went to a therapist for the first time. So I had done a ton of development work leading up to that. The thing that you can't do, I think, is do the actual rewiring in the brain of changing emotions that are tied to memories. Like, that's what you need the professional help with. And there's this, a ton of barriers here too, mostly financial, because therapy is expensive. And there's an awful lot of people that can't afford to spend, you know, whatever it is, $150 an hour as a therapist to work on this stuff. And I am super duper fortunate to be in the position that I am, that I was able to do that. But another angle that I would have to take on that is priorities. So when I was in early sobriety, well, most of my life, another thing that I inherited from my parents that took me a long time to overcome was my dad was not willing to pay anyone else anything for anything. He did everything himself. So he was his own mechanic and his own carpenter and his own electrician, which is probably in retrospect why the house was in shambles and the car was always broke down. You know, I thought that he was amazing that he knew how to do all of those things, but it turns out, you know, I take my car to the shop and they do whatever needs to be done in an hour. And he would spend weeks in the driveway working on that after work, right? So he wasn't very good at that stuff. But that mindset of not paying professionals to do something for you that's going to improve your life, I had to change that. I had to get past that. And small stuff, you know, I'm married to a veterinarian now, and I that opened up a blind spot for me that I didn't know that I had. I never took my dog to the vet to get shots and annual checkups and all the stuff, because, you know, why would I spend money on that? You know, I can take him to the feed store and get a $5 vaccine to get his county tag once a year, and like, everything else will be fine, right? Like, I was still living in that mindset of not paying professionals to do things for me that I can't do properly for myself. So I have financed an awful lot of stuff. I financed a hell of a drinking habit. I was spending $300 or $400 a month on alcohol every month to sit at home and drink by myself. And that was after I quit going out to bars. But I found a way to pay for the stuff. I smoked for 16 years because smoking helped me change the way that I feel in any moment. I found a way to do what needed to be done in those times. And I don't really have an excuse now for not finding a way to do what needs to be done. And so just forming the mindset of prioritizing what do I need and what are my resources to get that done, and how can I make this happen for me? And there's a lot of ways. I found there are grant programs. If you get on the internet and just Google grants for mental health, you will find an amazing number of programs out there that help pay for things for people. And I never knew any of this stuff existed. If you need help getting vaccines for your dog, there's 100,000 grants out there for that too. Like, there are foundations all over the world that are willing to pay for almost anything that you want to get done if you're willing to do a little legwork on getting there.
Your story is fascinating, and I want to bring it more up to date. I feel like an hour's not even touching the sides with your story, Justin.
No. You know, because of our long intro, Shaz, that's why.
That's why it's gone so quick. Note to self, stop wanging on at the beginning of the podcast. Give our guests much more time. Justin, when you joined this call, myself and Ben were both howling with laughter and going, oh, look at this picture, because your screensaver, I think it was you, correct me if I'm wrong, holding a donkey or a horse.
I'm going to say a baby donkey.
It's a baby donkey.
It looked like it was a little baby donkey.
Gorgeous.
Yeah.
So from that moment, we thought, we like him. We like him a lot. Now, I need to give this some context. So, you said you were married to Erica, veterinarian. Have I got that right?
Yep.
And your wife's mission is to make the world a better place for horses. Okay, I'm reading your bio here. Justin's mission is to make the world a better place for people by helping men learn to understand themselves and grow into their full potential. That's quite... Well, I mean, that's phenomenal. It's so far removed from the 10-year-old boy that you've described to us. You're now putting all that pain, all that experience, everything you've learned in sobriety, everything really over the course of pretty much a lifetime, into doing your bit to help others. Could you have imagined that?
Oh, not even close. Not even close. I think I was 6 years sober when I met my wife. And I had not gone through trauma therapy at that point. I had been to a regular therapist. But when I look back at that, so that was 2014. And I scratch my head. I don't know why my wife gave me the time of day at that point, because compared to where I'm at now, like, I was still a mess at that point. I had so far to grow. But I also know that 5 years from now, I will probably look back on this conversation and think, man, I didn't know anything back then. Because that's the beauty of continuous self-improvement and always growing into a better version of yourself. But I look at where I'm at now. I'm married to the most famous horse doctor in the world. We have the biggest equine podcast in the world. I'm running a veterinary clinic that continues to grow. I've written 8 books. I've done so many things just in the last 5 years that blow my mind. So, like, 2014, Justin, who was meeting Erica for the first time, like, I couldn't imagine all of the things that I'm doing today. At that point, I hadn't written a single book. I had recorded an album in my living room, so that was an accomplishment. And I painted a lot of paintings.
But we've not even talked about this yet. I can't believe this.
Like, my once I stopped worrying about who other people wanted me to be and I started trying to be who I want me to be, I haven't found the edges of that yet. I'm still growing into that. But the opportunities that have come from pursuing that course of action, from trying to figure out who I am and what I want to do with my life, like, that's how I keep doing all this stuff. Like, I got into the music, and then I got into painting, and then I got into writing, and now I'm into making videos and learning video production. And, like, all of this stuff like anything that's creative, what I've learned is anything that's creative is I like it. I have a side, I don't have any time to spare, but I have a side business building websites for other businesses because I love making websites, you know, putting all the pieces in the right place and making a really beautiful thing come together. Like the creative process is a really important part of me feeling good about what I'm doing with my time and my efforts on a regular basis. So I know that for me, I need to be doing something creative, and being a, you know, a business owner and running a business, there's a lot of bookkeeping involved in that and paying bills and trying to figure out how to spend money. Like there's a lot of number crunching in that. And that appeals to a part of me too. So I know that there are elements of various things that I need to make sure that I have in my life, no matter what it is that I'm engaged in. I need to do critical thinking because I'm an intellectual kind of guy, and I need to do something creative. And it doesn't really matter what those things are, but I need to be passionate about it. Because if I'm not passionate about what I'm doing, then I feel like I'm wasting time. And I already wasted my 20s and half of my 30s. So I'm trying to make up for a lot of that. But I am so engaged in the things that I do on a regular basis, whether it's, and right now I tell you, it's probably difficult to be married to me in some ways, because when I get excited about things, I really go off the deep end. But I have basically a television studio in the living room with $8,000 with the lights and cameras and all this stuff around. You know?
What a nightmare. Right. Can you imagine that? You were
I just
right
want to watch
about
the telly. We're making
you.
Telly, babe. We're making telly.
Yeah. But, you know, we also have a very active YouTube channel with 150 videos on there, and every one of those is better than the one before it. And, like, I get a lot of satisfaction out of that. And I think that's what it's about, is, like, what can I do that contributes something to the world and also makes me feel like a good person and happy about what I'm doing with my life and my time and my effort, right? I have a lot of energy to put out there, but just running out and chopping down a tree to burn it off isn't going to give me a sense of a satisfying life, right? I need to be finding the edges of my capacity. I'm trying to always grow to my capacity and expand that capacity and just keep pushing the edges and the boundaries. Cause I think, you know, we talk about in recovery, the complacency is a killer. And I absolutely believe that. And it doesn't matter if you're on day two or day 2000, if you get complacent, you're on a moving sidewalk. You're never going to stand still. You're either moving forward or you're moving backward. And I want to be moving forward.
I'm a quotes guy, Justin. In fact, I'd go so far to say that I am passionate about quotes.
Me too.
I've got a quotes board here in front of me. I love a good quote. And what you just said then reminded me of one of my favorites. For your countryman, Aaron Eckhart, the day you stop caring what other people think of you is the day your life begins.
I love it.
It's one of my absolute faves because it's so true, isn't it?
It is.
You know, I really do believe, like you said, that obviously, you know, lots of different things that have come along in your journey have helped you to kind of get to where you are now. But actually, it all started with self-awareness. But actually, it all started with removing alcohol. You know, one of my favorite things to talk about is how you remove alcohol and suddenly confidence starts growing in all these different areas. And, you know, it could be that, yeah, you know, I'm going to try that thing. And oh, actually, I really like making music or building websites or whatever. I think another one is, I don't care. You know, whatever. You think of me what you want to think. I'm not bothered. Right. You know, I love that quote so very much, and I think that's my thing, really. I want to help people realize that you mentioned it earlier, your dad was probably far too busy with his own shit to worry about what you were doing. You know, just don't care. Just think about yourself, think about your family, yes, of course, but forget all the people that don't matter. Right. You know what I mean?
When you learn to love yourself, it frees up so much of your time and your energy. When you learn to love yourself, you realize how much of your life before that you committed to managing other people's opinion of you so that you could get their approval. And it's stunning, stunning how much of our life we commit to people who hardly ever think about us. Like when you can commit that time to yourself and the people that care about you, like it's like having a whole extra lifetime. It is amazing, but it's also so much more gratifying because when you are living for someone else's approval, you're never going to get it. You never get there, right? That's the carrot that's dangled that you never get a hold of. But when you love yourself, you don't need that anymore. And I don't want to jinx myself and I don't want to give people a false understanding of what sobriety is. But when I love myself, I'm not really worried about relapse. I don't need alcohol anymore because I don't need to change the way that I feel about myself anymore. Like, that's where it's at. That is where everything is at.
Justin, it's been fab. It's just been a delight to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much for sharing what's only, like I said before, probably only a very small part of so much else that you've got to share. But I do feel we've got a real sense of where you've come from and where you are now and who you are. And it's been an absolute joy. Before you go, please, can you give a plug to your horsey pod, whatever that's about? We need to know more about this. And also the book as well. What's the podcast, Justin?
So the podcast is with my wife, obviously, and it's called Straight from the Horse Doctor's Mouth. And that is me interviewing her about a myriad of horse health related things. So I think we've got 137 episodes so far.
Love it.
If you listen to all of them, you'll be a horse expert, even if you've never seen on a horse.
Love it.
It's a lot of fun. But my book, I wrote a book about my journey through therapy, and it's kind of a fly on the wall experience of watching me go through each of my therapy sessions and what EMDR is and how we zip back and forth from 1985 to the present and really work through these traumas. So the book is called The Righteous Rage of a 10-Year-Old Boy. And it's on my website along with all my other books. I have a book series called The Adventures of the Horse Doctor's Husband, which is all true life horse emergencies and crazy animal stuff. So I'm trying to be the modern day James Herriot in as much as I would try to be somebody else. But so I've got that stuff going on. But my website is jboydlong.com. And I did that because I started out, I was going to be a sci-fi writer. I've got a sci-fi series too, so I was going to use my first initial.
Of course you have. Why wouldn't you have?
You knackered all the time, Justin.
I mean, come on.
So I built everything.
You give up one thing and you gain so much more. I mean, that is completely, that is Justin's life, isn't it?
It's mad. Amazing. He's an artist. He plays guitar. He's got a band, horses, sci-fi. And your book as well. Justin, you're fabulous. Thank you so much for joining us on Over the Influence. Justin B. Long, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you guys so much for having me on the show.